It's 7:43 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Teresa Wills. We'll hear about a long-lost piece of music written half a century ago by Philip Glass.
And this new score was, you know, presented to me as, well, look what we found here, and we should perform this.
And how is the pandemic affecting our food supply? That and more. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. The dust continues to settle from Tuesday's primary election in West Virginia. As Dave Mistich reports, many of the big races have a declared winner, but a handful of others have yet to be decided.
Governor Jim Justice won the Republican nomination and will face Democrat Ben Salango in November. Republican U.S. Senator Shelley Moore Capito will take on Democrat Paula Jean Swearengen. All three of the state's congressional representatives, David McKinley, Alex Mooney, and Carol Miller, won their primaries and will face their respective Democratic opponents in the upcoming general election. In state House races, Republican Senate President Mitch Carmichael was upset by teacher Amy Grady in the state's 4th District. Republican Delegate Eric Porterfield, who stirred controversy with anti-LGBTQ remarks, came in 5th in the primary for the 3-seat district in Mercer County. A tight race yet to be decided is the one for the Democratic nomination for Attorney General. With all precincts reporting, Delegate Isaac Spinagle is out in front of Sam Petsonk by less than 1,000 votes. Secretary of State Mac Warner says there are still thousands of absentee ballots that may be outstanding. Official canvassing begins Monday, June 15th. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Dave Mistich in Charleston.
For the latest results, visit us online at wvpublic.org. The coronavirus has highlighted many of our society's vulnerabilities, and that includes the systems we use to get food from the farm to the table. Lately, the pandemic has forced U.S. farmers to face the unthinkable. In some places, they've had to plow under perfectly good vegetables after schools and restaurants shut down and their market vanished. Livestock producers have had to euthanize hogs and chickens. They couldn't get the meat to consumers when workers got sick and packing plants shut down. As we enter into the growing season, U.S. farmers will rely on migrant workers who come for jobs they sorely need. But this year, some will come wearing face masks, worried they may take the virus home to their families. Trey Kay, host of WVPB's program Us and Them, has been thinking about how the pandemic has impacted the way Americans get their food.
I'm here with my colleague, Loretta Williams, and we're looking into the crystal ball to see what might become of our food supply.
I have to say, Trey, I think people would kiss our feet and shower us with flowers if we had that answer. The pandemic has shown the vulnerabilities of our food supply chain. I wanted to hear from someone who really sees the big picture, so I called Rob LaRue, president of the National Farmers Union. It's one of the oldest farmer organizations in the country. It represents, 200,000 small and mid-sized farmers. And Rob LaRue, by the way, grew up on a dairy farm in Monroe County, West Virginia.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. He says it's a place that nobody really knows where it is, so he was surprised when I asked.
Well, I know where it is.
I asked him why it's so hard for this food supply chain to shift. And he started out by saying that it's a complicated picture and that some places had been able to shift quickly, like Pennsylvania.
Great example of a state where the governor's office and the Department of Agriculture jumped in very quickly and looked at all of their growers that provided fruits and vegetables in general and connected them in a way with consumers that enabled them to find markets quickly to eliminate or at least reduce significant losses.
So Rob says that other states weren't that nimble and farmers did lose produce and animals that they didn't have a market for. A big part of that picture here has to do with how concentrated the market for a particular product is.
And because we have so few places that process this food and get it to consumers, you can have, when you have one or two or a small number even plants that end up closing, then that just has an enormous ripple effect all the way back down to the farm.
So that concentration piece, Trey, turns out to be really important. We've seen how some livestock farmers had to euthanize animals when workers got sick and meat packing plants had to shut down. Remember that?
Right.
It's the same for produce. Sean Peebles says he probably knows the 10 farmers who control most of the sweet potato supply in the United States. And Rob LaRue says that concentration is even greater in the meat industry.
In beef, 86% of our nation's beef supply is controlled by four companies. Those four companies, in order to make profits, have a very streamlined, centralized process. So for all of the thousands of farmers out there raising either hogs or beef or chickens or dairy, the vast majority of them are feeding into this highly concentrated market, creating problems.
So that's why when a few Midwestern pork processing plants shut down in mid-April, the pork supply started to react. And then suddenly, in some places, bacon and other processed pork became scarce. What has this pandemic taught us about what needs to change?
Well, the pandemic has really just highlighted a long-standing problem. And Rob says there are two things that he thinks could help.
We need to enforce antitrust laws. We've had decades now since the Ronald Reagan era of really very lax oversight and review of mergers and acquisitions, not just in the food supply, but across the gamut. And so, again, while this has created a very efficient and cheap food supply, it is not one that can withstand this kind of pressure. So I think enforcement of antitrust, looking at ways that Congress and states can incentivize the redevelopment of local and regional processing outlets. And I think for some areas, particularly Appalachia, but there's a lot of pockets around the country that are just ripe for this.
But Loretta, there's something I just don't understand. I mean, why couldn't all of that produce in Florida have gone to local food banks? I mean, it seems sad that it didn't at least go to those who needed it.
Right. I agree with you. Rob LaRue agrees with you. And he says that even that comes down to how people in the supply chain are connected.
But in those early days where folks were plowing under tomatoes and other crops, I mean, it was really sad and difficult to understand why that couldn't be utilized elsewhere. But at the time, our food banks were set up in a system that really relied heavily on food service and restaurants, quite frankly, to get a lot of products that they could then pass along to those in need. So for farmers, that was not a chain of a connection with the food banks. I think we'll see that begin to shift, which is going to be good for us in general. Certainly the needs for food banks are going to continue for a long time.
We've been listening to an excerpt of the latest episode of our podcast, Us and Them, titled COVID-19 Takes a Toll on Our Food Supply. To learn more about how farmers and migrant workers are taking precautions to stay safe during the pandemic, download Us and Them wherever you get your podcasts or listen online at wvpublic.org. This episode of Us and Them is presented with support from the West Virginia Humanities Council. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. It's 7:52. Becoming mostly sunny today, high temperatures in the 70s, clear overnight, lows in the 50s. Sunshine tomorrow with highs in the 80s, and sunny on Saturday with highs in the 70s. Support for WVPB is provided by Segra, providing next-generation communication solutions over an expanding fiber optics network. More information at segra.com. And by the CAMC Foundation, investing more than $2.5 million in educational assistance for nursing students who will practice at CAMC after graduation. More information at camcfoundation.org. Philip Glass's Music in Eight Parts was lost for 50 years, but the journey from discovery to a new recording is not a simple tale. Eclectopia's host Jim Lang interviewed Michael Reisman, director of the Philip Glass Ensemble.
Would you explain Music in Eight Parts, what that story was, please?
The story was basically that the piece was written around 1969. There was a couple of performances in 1970, and then the manuscript was lost for 40 years or something. It turned up at an auction at Sotheby's. The story was that Philip had actually sold the manuscript because he was in debt and needed the money. It surfaced. Dunvegan Publishers has got a hold of a copy of it. Then research was done by someone who was an intern at the time. He pieced the piece back together from the manuscript, which is basically a shorthand. It turned out there were parts that were able to be used in our own archive. Parts were able to be used to verify, oh yeah, this is the way it was. So anyway, a new score was made. And this new score was, you know, presented to me as, well, look what we found here, and we should perform this. Now, the original work and the original performances was not for this version of the ensemble. It was written in open score form, meaning that any kind of a group could play it. The phrase music in eight parts means that there were eight separate lines, eight separate individual simultaneous parts. So, you know, any combination to achieve that would work. I was then challenged to say, okay, I'm going to make an arrangement for our group. Now, there was no vocal in the original. I based the vocal part on one of the soprano saxophone parts from the original version. The original version being the score, which was for anything, plus the parts that Philip had copied out himself. Took the digital file that Alex Gray, who was the intern who had put it back together, took the digital file that he made and rearranged it to be something that would work with our current group. Then that was only the first part of the story. We didn't know, we have any idea how fast the piece should go. And I played it at different tempi, finished the arrangement at that point. But then something surprising turned up. A recording was found from the original performances. And that recording was very slow. And I thought, oh my goodness. So this is how Philip imagined the piece to be. In the meantime, I and the other players who had their parts already had gotten attached to playing it at a faster tempo. Well, I had already made three events that happened in the arrangement. I thought, well, I will start with something like the old sounds. And then we'll have a change in tempo with adding a bass and newer sounds. And then have a third change, which would make the bass deeper in the upper registers. You know, the soprano saxophones and the voice would go up an octave. That's what we did.
So it has elements of the past, kind of the monophonic, everybody playing the same thing. And then those different sections come in, and it's just tremendously exciting with the various tempi changes.
Well, I'm glad you like it.
I really like it.
For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Jim Lang.
Jim is the host of our radio show, Eclectopia. You can hear that program Fridays at 10 p.m. and Saturdays at 11 p.m. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Brittany Patterson produces our show. Our news director is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.